In a statement on Tuesday, March the 26th, Brazil's Foreign Affairs Ministry expressed concern about the upcoming elections in Venezuela, scheduled for July the 28th, particularly after opposition candidates have been disallowed from disputing the contest against President Nicolas Maduro, who has been in office now for more than 11 years. Maduro dismissed the Brazilian statement, suggesting that it had been dictated by the US State Department, but the leftist Lula government in Brazil has always veered away from criticising Maduro and his administration, with the latest statement showing an important change in stance, with the view that increasingly anti-democratic actions of Venezuela are now becoming impossible to defend. And if even Lula's government is criticising Maduro, how bad must the situation be in Venezuela? I'm Ewan Marshall, Deputy Editor of the Brazilian Report, and this is Explaining Brazil. If you like Explaining Brazil, you should subscribe to the Brazilian Report, the journalistic engine behind this podcast. We're an independent organization funded by our subscribers, and you can help us stay independent and continue to produce award-winning journalism. Our work has been recognized for its quality, and we've won several international awards. And the Brazilian Report was recently nominated for Best News Website in Latin America by the World Association of News Publishers, WANIFRA. To continue this work, we need your support. If you're already a subscriber, you can go the extra mile and join our Buy Me a Coffee fan page. And in return, you'll get exclusive perks like special newsletters and behind the scenes content, as well as a shout out here on our podcast. And today, I'd like to thank our Buy Me a Coffee members: Jaciara de Oliveira, Stu Whitaker, Carson Allen, Gabriel Luca, Andrei Novoseltsev, Pan Ludvik, Leslie Seal, Mark Hillary, Louise Renz, Erwan Menais, Aaron Berger, Kars Vriesvik, Alistair Townsend, Miller Renacido, Peter Abramson, David Dixon, José Ozzy Stankovic, Emerging Market Muser, Anna Lund, Peter Suffren, Anderson da Silva, and someone who wishes to remain anonymous. And our Buy Me a Coffee members come from all over the world, so please, if we're butchering the pronunciation of your name, please send us an email. If you too believe in the importance of independent journalism, and if you want to hear your name on our podcast, go to buymeacoffee.com/Brazilian Report and subscribe to one of our membership levels. Click on buymeacoffee.com/Brazilian Report to find out more. But before getting into today's episode, we've got another message for you.
Warm and friendly relations with the people of Brazil.
Hi, I'm Isabella Cruz from the Brazilian Report, and I'd like to invite you to listen to our special podcast, Love It or Leave It, the Brazilian military dictatorship from within to abroad, where we go in depth about the international connections of Brazil's past military regime. The first episode is already available, and the next ones will be on your feed soon. See you there!
And to get the latest on the situation in Venezuela, I'm delighted to welcome back Ignacio Portes, the Latin America editor for the Brazilian Report. Ignacio, lovely to have you on the show.
Good to be here again, Ewan.
Ignacio, around this time last year, when we were talking about Venezuela on the Brazilian Report, it almost looked as if Nicolas Maduro was going to be brought back into the international fold. Venezuela was negotiating with the US and the internal opposition over the 2024 elections. Here in Brazil, President Lula looked to be cozying up to Maduro and getting involved in a few photo opportunities beside him. But none of that seems to be the case anymore. So what's happened? Bring us up to date, if you will.
Right. I think since 2022, maybe since the Ukraine invasion by Russia, there started to be some rapprochement, which we covered extensively, between the US and Venezuela. Because of pragmatic reasons, the U.S. thought that they might need more potential access to Venezuelans' oil resources. So they started negotiating. There were a few deals to release prisoners from each side in 2022. The Biden administration released two nephews of Maduro's wife in exchange for a few Americans who were also detained. Then there was another prisoner exchange, which included the release by the White House of Colombian businessman Alex Saab, who was an important businessman very close to the Maduro administration, accused of all kinds of corruption. money laundering and so on. Then we had a very important man in the Venezuelan regime, Tariq El-Aissami, kicked off from the government. He was very close to Iran, which is a U.S. enemy. So, and you saw also U.S. easing sanctions against Venezuelan companies. So there were a lot of signs that Venezuela was starting to integrate with the West again, with the U.S. especially, but also they went to some meetings. He took some photos with Macron, as you mentioned, also some rapprochement with Lula in Brazil, although Lula was always more comprehended more, always tried to listen to the government of Venezuela a bit more. But this also raised some hopes amongst the Venezuelan opposition that the deal might include free elections. There were some promises of democratization included in the negotiations with the U.S. The U.S. at one point said that having free elections would be part of the conditions to ease all the sanctions against Venezuela. So there was hope that unlike in 2018, when the elections were pretty dodgy with a lot of candidates banned, that we would see free elections. But we started to see this falling off when the government said that the winner of the opposition primary would not be allowed to participate. And since then, the situation has changed, I think.
And so tell us a bit more about this opposition figurehead, Maria Corina Machado, who won the primaries. Where did she come from, and why did the Maduro government feel justified in disqualifying her from the election race this year?
Right. Well, Machado is one of the more, let's say, hardline opposition to the Maduro regime. She's a right winger, always very skeptical of negotiating with the government. Generally, there's always a hard line and a soft line with the government. Some say that, well, we need to accept participating in elections. And sometimes Machado said, no, we shouldn't participate in these elections because these are rigged or stuff like that. But in this case, she decided to at least participate in the primary after, despite the fact that the government had already banned her once from running for the presidency in the past for collaborating with other opposition figures. This time the ban was for collaborating with Guaido. Remember this alternative president that Venezuelan opposition created after they said that the 2018 elections were rigged. So they said that the leader of the assembly, which was the only validly elected member, should actually be the valid president, and some foreign countries accepted it, and so on. Well, Machado was part of the people who supported Guaido, so the government now banned Machado for this. But she had already been banned from a previous election, and she had been a figure known for both having ties with the U.S. He once met with George Bush. He, like a long time ago, right when George Bush was president, her parties are generally the ones that received in some ways support from the U.S. via NGOs or stuff like that. Known for, well, when Chavez was still alive, she confronted him when he went to speak to Congress. So she was like one of the strongest, most well-known opposition figures. And when she ran in the opposition primary, she was by far the most well-known candidate. And she got like 90% of the votes in that opposition primary, which was done informally, right outside of the government accepted structure to run a primary. They allowed it to happen, but they did not rubber stamp it as a state sanctioned primary. And immediately after she was elected chosen with 90% of the, or more or less of the votes in the primary, the government started the courts that respond to the government, because by this point, all courts are basically more or less controlled by the Chavista regime. They said that, well, because of her role with Guaido, she wouldn't be allowed to run, and that's where people started to realize that, okay, maybe this we were too naive about having elections this year.
So, yeah, from a Brazilian perspective, the Lula government had backed the decision to disqualify Machado, with the president himself saying that she should stop crying and appoint someone to run in her place, like Lula did with Fernando Haddad in 2018. But now the real outrage from Brazil and other countries seems to be that Machado's stand-in has also been disqualified from the running. So what happened there, Ignacio? What were the grounds for that candidate being disqualified as well?
Well, that was more, even more overt. Like, there were basically, when they delayed their announcement of the candidate until the last minute of Corina Giannis, and a couple of days before the deadline to register a candidate, they announced her in public with Machado standing beside her, basically to show that, hey, this is my candidate, like Lula with Haddad and or something like that. But so basically they delayed in order to prevent any bans from emerging against a newly elected candidate, right? And they pick a pretty obscure figure, a philosopher from university with not a lot of activity in politics. But still, when they went to register the name, the system, the online system to register candidates wasn't working suddenly. Then they went to register in person, and for some reason they didn't accept her either. So basically, they didn't have a pretty good excuse to ban her, but they still banned her. Not banned her, but they are saying, hey, she's not in any register. She's not a candidate because the system wasn't working, and we don't have a piece of paper that says she will run. So by now, only Maduro is a registered candidate, and a few other, not only Maduro, but Maduro is the only really strong figure. And there's also other figures that most of this relatively unified opposition front sees as, how do you call it, a fake figure accepted to pretend that we have a real election, but really controlled by the government in some way or other. Some people with that were at some point part of the opposition, but now the government controls them with some court cases, threatening to put them in prison if they don't do what they need, or some evangelical one. Maybe it's, in the past they did the same with an evangelical pastor that was close to the government. They allowed him to run, and this kind of figures that are in the surface not part of the government, but in some ways close to it, that they can control, and that they're not very popular in the opposition, so they can still win the election.
And so if there were to be free elections in Venezuela this year, whether that be with Machado or a proxy, how would we rate the opposition's chances?
I think they would have a very, very real chance of winning, because the last time we really had free elections in Venezuela, to me, it was in 2015. There was a midterm election which really changed, I think, the dynamics of Venezuela. The opposition won a comfortable victory, and they took almost 2/3 of the National Assembly, which allowed them to do pretty much anything. When you had 2/3 of an assembly, you can rewrite a constitution. You can do a lot of things. And this was a, I mean, the government expected maybe that it might be a close election, but they lost by more than they thought, and it really got complicated for them. And so first they started to question the election of just a couple of lawmakers, just to make sure that they couldn't reach the 2/3. They say that particular election in a remote province was rigged in some way, because they gave some money to people to go vote for the candidate. It was a bit of a dodgy case that they opened against these lawmakers, but that stopped them, or stopped them from, or at least questioned the 2/3 majority. And then they created a parallel assembly with a constitutional reform process in 2017. They basically, by decree of the executive, the Maduro administration said, okay, we're going to reform the constitution, and to reform the constitution, we're going to create an assembly from scratch, basically whose representatives are going to be picked regionally, but really picked by the government, ultimately. So they created this parallel assembly, constitutional assembly, they called it, and which stripped the original assembly of its powers. And so they couldn't accept losing the legislative branch of government. And this was all happening simultaneously with the worst moment of economic crisis in Venezuela. 2017 is the moment of catastrophic hyperinflation, brutal hunger, the worst economic crisis that the continent has seen in a lot of time, the peak of exiles, the peak of malnutrition, people losing 20, 30 pounds of weight because they had no food. So imagine you don't have a chance of winning, you don't have a lot of chance of winning an election in that context. So this is why they rigged the 2018 elections. They only allowed two candidates other than Maduro, and they were this kind of control candidates that we're talking about. Since then, there was a bit of an economic recovery. The government did some, we call them in the website, some kind of Deng Xiaoping reforms, some like still having a political control over the country by the Socialist United Party of Venezuela, but more pragmatic economic reforms, allowing again oil production to improve, local more normal regulations for local food market and so on. So the country recovered a little bit. I mean, compared from rock bottom, but still, is that enough for people to forget all these years of suffering and vote for the unquestionably vote for the Maduro government and reelect him very happily? I don't think so. I mean, maybe they would have a small chance of winning, but it would be far from granted. And the government fears losing power, like a government that has so many corruption accusations, such a horrible past of economic crisis. They fear revenge. They fear going to jail. They fear getting killed. They fear all kinds of what happens when this big, powerful government lose power. So, and they're not going to give that up easily. They decided to not give it up at all. So I think they have a real feeling that they will lose, or they have a big chance of losing. And that's why they're not accepting elections clean elections in the last 8 or 9 years.
So what's next then? How do we expect the opposition to react? And, you know, we mentioned the US at the start of the show. So how do we expect the US to react?
Well, the US has already condemned Venezuela. You've seen multiple State Department press releases saying that first we're worried about these questions over the Machado candidacy. Then we're strongly condemned and so on and so forth. The negotiations are broken, I think, clearly. We've also seen some escalating incidents, just in the same way that you saw some signs of goodwill in 2022, 23. Now you're seeing some signs of badwill, like this. You cannot prove it, but this guy that was killed in Chile, this member of the opposition to the Maduro government that was kidnapped. He was exiled in Chile, right? A former military guy. And he was kidnapped and dismembered and just a gruesome murder in Chile by Venezuelans, apparently, which you still cannot fully prove that he was connected to the Maduro regime, but it looks likely. This happened a couple of months ago, less, 1 month ago. And stuff like that, it makes you feel like the Maduro government has no hopes in signing any kind of agreement with the U.S. anymore, and the U.S. government has already escalated sanctions once again against Venezuelan mining companies, against Venezuelan oil companies. I think the oil companies are not in effect yet, but they're moving in that direction. And also, if Trump wins, which is a pretty realistic possibility at this point, the Maduro government, I think, expects even more escalation, even less of a soft line, a dovish. Let's see what we can negotiate with the socialist government in Venezuela. So I think both sides see that this is not going to work out. That this is a divorce, not even a divorce. Because they weren't really allies at any point. They were just talking again, right? This is we're in non-speaking terms again, let's say. Neighbors that never liked each other much, then they decide, okay, let's talk. And now I don't think they're going to talk anymore.
And as I referenced at the top of the show, for Maduro's government to face criticism from leftist allies in Brazil and Colombia, I mean, something must have gone pretty badly wrong. I mean, you mentioned the elections in 2015, but if you could just circle back a bit further maybe and tell us how Venezuela has taken this path towards anti-democratic rule.
Yeah, I think you got to go back to the Chavez years, right? Like the question of democracy in Venezuela went back and forth many times. I think history helps understand it a bit. Of course, Hugo Chavez was the big political figure, right? Predecessor of Nicolas Maduro, really more charismatic, your typical populist, popular leader who speaks the language of the people and promises redistribution of goods and a more even participation in political society and in economic society and so on. Chavez was a kind of a larger than life figure who in his career, his first big public appearance in the political scene was in 1992 with a coup attempt in Venezuela during the Caracazo, which was a massive protest against this neoliberal reforms in the early 90s in Venezuela to try to stabilize the economy, balance the books, balance public accounts, and so on. But these were your typical IMF-supported reforms in a very destabilized macroeconomic landscape, very strong austerity with a lot of protests. And the protests were met with brutal, brutal violence in the streets by the police and by the state regime forces. There were like hundreds of deaths in the streets. So Chavez responded to this. He was part of the Venezuelan military, right? A rebellious group within the Venezuelan military by launching a coup attempt against the repressive government in 1992. He went to jail for that. Then he was amnestied. And in 1998, he came back with proposing, okay, I'll win democratically. I'm a popular figure. I'll win. And he was a popular figure. He was a rising popular figure. And he softened his prophet a little bit, said that we don't support Cuba. He had these ties to Fidel Castro, but he said in a famous TV election, no, we believe Cuba is a dictatorship. We don't want to be like Cuba. Like, we don't want to interfere in Cuba. Of course, they are an independent country. We don't like the blockades and so on, but we don't want to be like Cuba. We're different. We just want a more fair country. And in the first few years, he exposed all this land reforms, economic redistribution policies. And this was immediately met by obviously resistance from local elites, but also, and only a few years down the road, by a coup backed mostly by the U.S. and, I mean, by Venezuelan elites foremost, but also by the U.S. during the Bush administration. In 2001 or 2002, I don't recall it. I think 2001. They launched a brief coup with this guy Carmona, who was a business leader against these proposals, opposing this constitutional reform proposal of the Maduro administration, of the Chavez administration. And for a couple of days, Chavez was exiled internally jailed by the new forces. Then there was a popular uprising that brought Chavez back to power, and basically at that point, Chavez was the democratic figure and the Venezuelan elites were the anti-democratic figures. So the landscape, this created a lot of goodwill, I think, in the Latin American left towards the Chavez administration and towards this left-wing government. It was the most radical left-wing government of this pink wave that we saw in Latin America in the 2000s, right? But it was so strongly persecuted by the country's elites and by the U.S., who also then supported all kinds of oil strikes and boycotts against the government, that it generated a lot of sympathy among many, many people in Latin America that said, we need to defend this government. But this slowly started to change, I think, 10 years after this 2002 coup attempt, 2001, 2002 coup and destabilization attempts by the right wing in Venezuela, that I think the goodwill lasted like 10 years more. But then the economy started to deteriorate a lot. Chavez died. And the regime became more indefensible as time passed. The channels to oppose the government became more restricted. The public TV channels were either closed or forced to sell if they opposed the government too much. We started to see these candidate bans, first with some more radical figures like Leopoldo López, but then also with the centrists like Capriles, who was more of a social democrat, but anti-Chavez, but also he was banned from running in previous elections. You started to see a more turning to an autocratic regime. As the economy started to look worse and worse, the government became more and more authoritarian. I think within the military, which is the key power player in Venezuela, the government, with the history of coups, they managed to purge all the military from people who would not be completely loyalist to the regime. And this allowed them to control the country by force. Any sign of opposition, they could immediately put the military on it and say, hey, we have a coup attempt here. We have a potential. This guy is linked to a guy that was originally part of the 2002 coup in some way. In this way, they started to purge institutions from all signs of opposition. Then they purged the electoral authorities, and then it was full control of the Maduro regime. Even in the worst economic circumstances, they could start to rig the elections. Even though during the Chavez years, they even lost one election, since they lost this second election that I was talking in 2015, and they lost it by a huge margin, they said, we cannot risk this happening again, and we're going to keep the democratic veneer in some way, but we're going to go full Stalinist. just control Stalin slide, I mean, but just only the facade of democracy. And if we don't like you, you're just not going to run. The system fell. I don't know what happened, but you're not allowed in here. And this is where we are right now, sadly. It's been a pretty tragic history of Venezuela over the last years.
Ignacio, plenty for us to pour over there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Ivan. Pleasure to talk to you.
Ignacio Portes is the Brazilian Report's Latin America editor, and premium subscribers can read up about all the latest goings on in the region in our Latin America weekly newsletter, which is in your inbox every Wednesday afternoon. And go to brazilian.report/subscribe to find out more. If you like Explaining Brazil, please give us a 5-star rating wherever you get your podcasts. Or better yet, subscribe to The Brazilian Report, the journalistic engine behind this podcast. We have a subscription-based business model, and your memberships fuel our journalism and keep us going and growing. Our work has been recognized for its quality, and we've won several international awards. And recently, The Brazilian Report was nominated for Best News Website in Latin America by the World Association of News Publishers, WANIFRA. And to continue this work, we need your support. So go to brazilian.report/subscribe. I'm Ewan Marshall. Thanks for listening. And Explaining Brazil will be back next week.